So before we start, let me briefly recapitulate what we have done yesterday. So we discussed all maximally symmetric spaces, and they locally, they can all be described by this very nice construction, is that basically I embed in, to get an n-dimensional maximally symmetric space, I embed in n plus one dimensional auxiliary space, if you want, equipped with this metric here, eta, ab, p, q, and k, where k is just a discrete thing which takes values plus minus one or zero, and this pq is the signature of this Minkowski-like metric here. And then the surface itself is simply described by this equation here. If you differentiate this equation, solve for the xn plus one square, plug it over here, you get the following metric on that surface, and that's the metric for local metric for any maximally symmetric space. Okay, so examples, of course, we have seen that we have, for example, the sphere, or the hyperboloid, or the Minkowski space. Then we have Minkowski space, an ADS space, and De Sitter space, and all other spaces. But we shall see that the first three are actually very, very important for cosmology, because they will be the building blocks of the metric describing our universe. This will be the building blocks. Blocks for the metric describing our universe, and that's FRW metric. We will see it in a minute. We also argued that because of the integrability condition of Killing's equation, there is at most, for any spacetime, there is at most n times n over 2 Killing vectors, which corresponds to how many fields psi A I can specify at one point, and how many antisymmetric fields LAB, which is the derivative of psi. But it's also antisymmetric due to Killing equation I can have at one point. And then using the Taylor expansion, I can find the Killing field anywhere, because all the higher derivatives are actually given in terms of these two. Okay, so at most, I can have this number of Killing vectors. So in four dimensions, I can have 10 Killing vectors. Of course, Minkowski space has 10 Killing vectors. But the statement is that this guy will also have 10 Killing vectors, and that guy will also have Killing vectors. So we'll have these. Okay, so I haven't really shown that, but the construction can be found, for example, in Weinberg. So if you are interested in the explicit construction of these Killing vectors, just look into Weinberg's book. You will construct explicitly these Killing vectors for Minkowski just using this integrability condition in your tutorial. Okay, so now, by the way, just to a little bit convince you that really all these spaces have that, is the fact that if you look at the constraint here, this constraint is actually invariant under some change of coordinates. So I can actually, constraint or the surface is invariant. Invariant under the following change of coordinates, and it's a linear change. So I can go from x to x tilde a, and there will be lambda ab xb, where these matrices are actually constant matrices which obey basically something like a Lorentz condition, but not in the Lorentzian metric, but in this metric eta ab pqk. Okay, so where this is eta ab pq and k is given by eta cd pq and k lambda c a lambda d b. Okay, so if you actually do the following coordinate transformation where this is true, the matrix is lambda obey this relation, then actually the constraint remains exactly the same. Okay? So now, of course, you can write this infinitesimally, and you will find that actually these lambda matrices actually form a representation of an orthogonal group. Okay? So lambda AB. So lambda AB form a representation of O, and now you have P plus K plus 1 over 2, and then Q plus 1 minus K over 2. So this is for K, which is not 0. Of course, for K equal to 0, this is all trivial, and we just are back to just the standard thing. So we don't have this 1 half here. We always have the whole number here, the whole number here. And so, of course, now you can do whatever you are used to with the Minkowski or with the Lorentzian group. And so you can do it infinitesimally. You can write lambda AB as delta AB plus small lambda AB, as always you do. And then you can lower the index of this guy here. So you can write lambda AB using our metric. So eta AC, PQ, and K, and lambda CB. So this is how you define this in this object is in both indices down. And then, of course, I have to take this, I have to plug into that relation here, as you do with the standard things, and you find that this is actually minus lambda BA. So the only restriction is that this lambda is, this infinitesimal lambda, the generators are actually in, anti-symmetric when you write both indices down. Okay? And so, because it's anti-symmetric, but the index runs from 1 to n plus 1, I have n plus 1 over 2 these generators. So we have n plus 1 over 2 generators. And surprise, surprise, these generators will actually correspond to that number of Killing vectors. And if you compare this number, n plus 1 over 2 with that number, they actually precisely match. So this is an indication, almost a proof, that all these spaces actually have maximum number of Killing vectors. Okay? Are there any questions to this? As I said, if you want an explicit construction of these Killing vectors, just look into Weinberg's book. Very good. So now we will use these maximally symmetric spaces to actually construct our metric, which describes our universe. So part B, FRW spacetime. So F stands for Friedman, Robertson, Walker spacetime. So three gentlemen who actually, it's also one more, but poor guy, he's not typically mentioned. Okay, so now we know that our space, our universe is isotropic and homogeneous. Okay, so if you want to discuss the symmetry of universe, then we have basically the rotational symmetry due to the isotropy. So no matter where we are looking, it's the same thing. So we have rotational symmetry. Which comes from isotropy. So, and then we have homogeneity, so which is translational symmetry.
Imaginate.
Okay. So actually, we can do any rotations on this. So we have three killing vectors here. And then we can also translate in any direction. So we have another three killing vectors for the translations. So in total, actually, our universe is described by a metric which admits six killing vectors. So it is not maximally symmetric. We actually like boosts, right? So typically, if you had, you would have something like boosts for additional killing vectors, but we don't have those. So, okay, so we don't have boosts. And so the FRW spacetime won't be maximally symmetric. But if we don't have boosts, then of course there exists a preferred frame, which actually makes the space nice. Okay, if you have boosts, then the frame is not really, you know, you can travel with velocity, constant velocity, or whatever, but whatever. Okay, so there exists a preferred frame. I got it wrong, probably. It's probably 1F and double R, preferred frame. And so this preferred frame, of course, if you think about frames physically, you think about observers, right? And so this preferred frame is called commoving observer. And so, you know, all this makes perfect sense. So this observer will see homogeneous and isotropic universe. But any other observer who is actually, you know, accelerating with respect to this observer or, you know, moving with respect to, he won't see that. Okay? Which, of course, made sense, right? So if I have a fluid and I commove with that fluid, I can see, you know, the same things all the time. But if I start moving, let's say accelerating, with respect to that fluid, I see suddenly that, you know, things are coming at me from one direction and receding from the other direction and so on, right? So actually, this commoving observer is the only observer who sees this homogeneity and isotropy. If you start moving with respect to that, if you start moving with respect to the average galaxies and stuff like that, you will see strange things happening, like radiation coming at you and stuff like that, okay? So now, to describe this observer, so uses coordinates. And so these coordinates, I better choose the coordinate t, which will be proper time of the observer, proper time of commoving observer. And then I need three more, and I'll call them xi. And so these are basically the positions of these commoving observers. Okay, so xi equals to constant correspond to the observer. So if the observer is just, you know, okay. So he's described by these xi coordinates that defines where the observer is. And then this is his proper time, lapsing there. Okay, so this is really given all to you by the symmetry. And then this observer really sees homogeneous and isotropic universe. So if I fix t equal to constant, then I have to see three-dimensional maximally symmetric space. Okay, so if I reduce one dimension down, I fix t equal to constant, I have to see maximally symmetric space. And so, In these coordinates, our universe is maximally symmetric. But not in four-dimensional sense, but in the three-dimensional one. So at a given instant of time, at a given instant of the proper time of the common link observer, I see the three space to be maximally symmetric. But of course, later time, I have to also see it maximally symmetric, but it can be of different size. So actually, this will be multiplied by the scale factor, as we will see in a minute. So it's maximally symmetric on a spatial slice. And spatial geometry can, however, can arbitrarily arbitrarily stretch or shrink in time. And so this shrinking and stretching is described by scale factor. So this is described by a scale factor. Typically denoted by A. And it's a function of time. Okay. So this is just in words described that the metric inevitably has to be of this form. Ds square is just minus dt square plus a square of t, and then maximally symmetric space. But now I have to choose the one which actually is spatial. So I'll choose the signature 3,0. So no time, but I can still have an arbitrary curvature k, gij 3,0k, dxi, dxj. And so this metric is called FRW spacetime. Or we know how these metrics look like. So let me use that formula over there. And so this is minus dt square plus a square delta ij plus k xi xj rho square minus k x square dxi, dxj. Okay. And so this is the famous FRW metric. And this depends on t. Make sense. So for at any instant of time, I see, so if I fix t, this is gone, and I see maximally symmetric space. Okay, and this is only, of course, for the observer, for the frame associated with this common link observer. Okay. Very good. So now we have the metric describing our universe. So we will use it for some things, but before actually it's useful to write it in various coordinate systems. But first, some terminology. So if you have k equal to 0 here, so this metric is completely specified up to this one function, which is function of time only, the scale factor, and then this k, which you know can be something depending on the observation. Okay, so for k equal to 0, of course, we have Euclidean space, then maximally symmetric space is the Euclidean space. And we call the universe flat universe. For k equal to plus 1, we have a sphere on that spatial slice. And we call it a closed universe. And for k equal to minus 1, we have the hyperboloid, which is precisely the hyperboloid we have seen yesterday, but one dimension higher. And this is called open universe. Okay. One more remark is that we have this rho here, which is basically the curvature. But we can always set it equal to 1 by doing some scaling transformation of coordinates. So can and will set rho equal to 1. And so this can be achieved by, for example, rescaling x according to the following. So you can do xi tilde, okay, xi, the old ones in terms of the new ones is rho times xi tilde. And then a is a tilde divided by rho. So if you do this coordinate transformation, then actually rho just drops out of your metric. And so since now on, you'll be just setting rho equal to 1 in this metric. So I'll have 1 here. But of course, that has some consequence. And if you look at it here, actually, it tells you that basically now A describes the curvature of your space-time. So then A of t is the radius of curvature of spatial slice. Okay. So anyway, so this is just to simplify alive to destroy rho, just set it equal to 1, and then A assumes this geometrical meaning. Yes?
Why not it's A tilde?
Sorry?
Why isn't it A tilde?
Well, okay. So these are old coordinates, these are the new ones, right? So what I'm doing is I'm plugging for old ones into here. Everywhere I find that rho drops out, so it just becomes 1. So now I'm dropping the tildes.
Oh.
And then you know I'm saying that this metric is rho equal to 1.
But when you have the two conventions, it will be it's a tilde with the radius of curvature.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, but I dropped it. I dropped it already. Yeah, sure. No, you're right. Questions? Okay, so just a stupid picture. The scale factor, of course, is determined by the meta content. Through the Einstein equations. And we will not study it today, but we will study it tomorrow. So we will write down the Einstein equations tomorrow. But at this point, it's just something which depends on time. So in principle, you can have A and T, and we know the universe is expanding, so it can be something like this. Okay. So at this point, the scale factor just behaves like this. But of course, the precise curve will be given by you know, what matter is dominating and whatever. Okay, so it's useful to introduce two parameters which describes this time evolution of the scale factor. One of them is the Hubble expansion rate, and is just given by the first derivative of A divided by A. So this is Hubble's expansion rate. And there is another quantity which actually has two derivatives of A in it. And that's also sometimes useful. It's denoted by Q. And it's A double dot and then A h square. And this is called the deceleration parameter. Of course, that comes from the history when people thought that actually the expansion is slowing down. So it's decelerating. Our universe is still expanding, but decelerating. But that's actually not true. It's accelerating. So maybe nowadays you would call it whatever. Okay. So that's these two parameters basically characterize how the scale factor behaves. Okay. So far, everything is very simple. Now, people typically don't use these coordinates. They use different coordinates. So let me introduce these other coordinate systems as well, so that you are familiar with them. So other coordinate systems. The simplest one is the spherical. So you just go from these quasi Cartesian coordinates to something like spherical coordinates. So I'll just write the standard transformation. X1 is r times sine theta and cosine phi. And then x2 is r sine theta, sine phi, and x3 is r cosine theta, which is the standard transformation as you would do it. And then that metric over there, of course, dt part is still there, but now it looks almost like spherical coordinates. So we have ds square is minus dt square plus a square of t times dr square 1 minus kr square and plus r square d omega square, where just d omega square is the standard metric on a sphere. Okay? So this is another coordinate system, which is called spherical one. And sometimes people use this metric to describe that problem. Perhaps more often is used basically this system, but with a different radial coordinate. So let me introduce a new radial coordinate. So new radial coordinate. Okay, so I'll denote this coordinate chi, and it's given in terms of r. So this is my original r, and this is given by sk of chi. This sk is either sine chi for k equal to plus 1, or it's chi for k equal to 0, or it's sine h chi for k equal to minus 1. Okay, so now you basically introduce new coordinate chi, which is this weird function of r through the inversion of these functions here. And if you do that, then actually that deals with that 1 minus k over r square in the denominator. And your metric becomes ds square is minus dt square plus a square of t. And then you have d chi square plus s k square of chi d omega square. Okay, so this is your metric now. So you basically moved the ugly part from dr square to here. Okay. That's another frame which people use. And actually, a funny thing is to look at what is the physical meaning of this coordinate r with respect to the physical meaning of this coordinate chi. So I can draw it for k equal to plus 1 case, not for equal to k equal to minus 1 case. Of course, k equal to 0 is trivial. So k equal to plus 1. And so let us look at what's happening through this embedding point. So embedding viewpoint. Okay. So in this case, we are discussing that the spatial slice is a three-dimensional sphere. And we embed this three-dimensional sphere in a four-dimensional space. Okay, so we get a picture like this. So this is x4, this is x1, this is x2, and then I'm suppressing x3 because I cannot draw it. And then I have a sphere here. Okay. So now you place yourself always in the most important point on the sphere, which is the top. It's a very distinguished point on the sphere. Okay, so here there is a guy, our observer, that is us. Okay. And so the spatial slice is described by the surface of the sphere. Okay. So in particular, I may be looking at a star on that surface. Right? I'm looking at that star, and that star will be living on that surface of the sphere here. Okay. So now, what is the meaning of the coordinate R? So if you look at the definition, which is now hiding, oh no, it's not. It is hiding. So the definition of R is just R squared is x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared. Okay, so it's just the standard spherical thing. So I have x1 square plus x2 square, which is basically this thing here. I'm suppressing x3 square, but it will be somewhere here. So this is precisely what I mean by R. Okay, so that's the meaning of R. So you see that the R coordinate really doesn't measure how far the star is on the surface of the sphere. But the meaning of R is rather through this embedding thing. So actually, R is not the most natural coordinate from this point of view, because it doesn't measure this distance, but rather it measures that distance. Okay? So R is not that nice, but chi will be. Okay, so R is this thing here. So remember that the radius of the sphere was rho, but I set rho equal to 1. Okay, so the distance to my star up to here is rho equal to 1. And then in this case, I have the relation that R is sine chi. Okay, so that's my definition of chi in the case of k equal to plus 1. But if you look at that R is sine chi, but rho is 1, then actually chi is this angle here. But because it's angle here and the radius of the sphere is 1, then chi is also this thing here. So chi really measures how far the object is if you are on that surface. So chi is actually much more natural coordinate than R is in some sense. So chi describes from the 3D, if you want, perspective. And R describes things better from the embedding perspective. You know, just as a curiosity. Of course, you don't typically don't care, right? You just have some coordinate system, either R or chi, and you use that coordinate system. Yes.
Embedding is the hyperboloid outside the light cone, right? Why is it sphere?
Oh, I'm just plotting k equal to plus 1 here, which is the sphere. I wouldn't be able to plot k equal to minus 1. It's too difficult.
It's 3-0, not.
So this is really drawn two-dimensional thing of a four-dimensional embedding of a three-dimensional sphere. Yes.
Excuse me?
Yeah?
But if you go to chi is equal to pi, then r is equal to 0, but you are on the opposite.
Yeah?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I see.
Yeah. All right. So that's the meaning and the relation between r and chi. So there is finally one more coordinate system, which is used, and so people introduce so-called conformal time. So C introducing conformal time. And so this conformal time is simply to make it all equal. So T and all the other coordinates equal setting. So you introduce, so a conformal time will be denoted by eta. And so you introduce it by dt equals to A times d eta, or you can integrate it if you want. Eta minus eta 0 is an integral 0 to t dt over a t prime. Okay? But so this is the defining relation for your conformal time, and the advantage of that is that your metric now in both coordinate systems can be written as, you simply put a square in front of everything. So a square of eta now, and then minus the eta square plus the r square 1 minus k r square plus r square d omega square. That's one coordinate system. All the other one is over here. A square of eta minus d eta square plus d chi square plus sk of chi square d omega square. Okay, so that's the last coordinate system which is typically used in cosmology. And of course, the advantage of this eta is, so if you look at, for example, this expression here, and consider k equal to 0 case, so specifically, if you say k equal to 0, then you see that in both instances, actually our FRW spacetime is just conformal to the Minkowski flat space. So FRW is just conformal Minkowski. So if you have flat universe, then FRW space is really, really simple. So by conformal, I mean that it's actually a square times Minkowski. Right, so it's just a scaled Minkowski case. Are there any questions towards coordinate systems?
Is there an intuition of what this conformal time means? Like
also, this conformal time is very, very nice. For example, if you consider the motion of light, mm-hmm. or if you consider the motion of light, this thing actually is not interesting. And so let's say I consider radial things, so this is gone. So then I will have just chi and eta. So that's very useful for discussing light, as you will see in a minute. Yeah. Okay, so now something the cosmology group at the Winter School was very obsessed about is the peculiar velocity and stuff like that. So let me explain what it is. And let me simplify my life to do it in the flat universe again. Although the generalization to the other is very simple. So now if you look at your FRW spacetime and look at the coordinates don't really measure, let's say, dxi square. It doesn't really measure the true distance. The true distance is always multiplied by a square. Okay? So Hubble flow. So let's say I denote physical distance. I'll be discussing this for k equal to 0, but it doesn't matter. So physical distance, I'll just call these xi physical is just a times a of t times these coordinates characterizing my common weak observer. So this is really the physical distance given by a metric. Okay. So now, if this is true, then the physical velocity which is just derivative of this, vip is d xi p over time. So let's say I measure, okay, I do it in time. Okay, so now of course I have two things which may in principle be depending on time. So I may be moving, so this xi, if I sitting with the commoing observer, is of course a constant. But if I am changing with respect to this commoing observer, this is still a function of time. Okay, so I will have actually two contributions to this velocity. So let's say I first differentiate this one, dxi over dt, or I differentiate the second one. So a dot and then xi. So these are the two terms that can contribute. So now a dot is of course a dot over a times a. definitely true. But a dot over a is, by my definition, the Hubble's constant. So I have two terms. So I have h times a times xi is xi physical. Xi physical. So that's the second term. And then I have this one here, which is a times dxi over dt. And this thing here is called the peculiar. So we have two contributions to the physical velocity. So how really, you know, how is physical distance to a star, how is it changing? It's changing. There are two contributions. One of them is due to this expansion of the universe, where h plays the role. Okay, so this is called Hubble's law. And describes the velocity due to expansion of the universe. In other words, how A is changing in time. Whereas the other one is called peculiar velocity. And so it measures how these xi coordinates are changing. So actually, how I am moving with respect to the commoing observer. Okay, so peculiar velocity, which is the velocity with respect to commoing observer. So, you know, just to notice that there are these two contributions, how the objects are moving away or whatever. So this is something which will be sort of uniform. It's dictated by the universe. This is something I can sort of dictate locally. I can say that, yeah, actually the galaxies are moving, you know, randomly at that point, and so they can be moving towards me and so on. And that's described by peculiar velocity. All right. So now we will do some simple exercise. We will study the motion of test particles in the universe. So basically solving a geodesic equation for light and for matter. But we will see that we will learn some interesting things about the universe. So another thing will be motion of test particles. And I don't really mean particles, I mean radiation and other things. Okay. So motion will be described by their momentum. And I will define this momentum to be the derivative of my coordinates with some parameter lambda. And so the meaning of lambda is not proper time, but it's related to proper time by mass m. So it's just I don't want to carry the mass at certain places, but I want to carry it in other places. So so if you want the proper time or whatever in case of massive particles, it's related to the lambda parameter and the mass of the particle like that. But I'll be using the same lambda for massless particles as well, except that this will not be true. Okay. So then if I define it in this way, then just the magnitude of this, so p squared, and then I'll be using the first form of the matrix. I'll be using these xi coordinates, right? So the first form of the matrix, so it's just minus p0 square comes from minus dt square, and then plus a square gij p0 k. And then dxi over d lambda, it's pi, and then pj. Okay, so that's how the magnitude of the four vector p looks like. So now, to make it even simpler, let's just call this capital P square. Then I have minus p0 square plus p square, and then using this lambda parameter, this will be just given by minus m square. Okay, so that's just the normalization of my momentum describing the geodesic motion. Okay, everybody happy so far? So now we want to solve the geodesic equation. So of course the geodesic equation is just given by p mu nabla mu d nu equals to zero. Okay, so that's very nice. We know that this equation can be derived from a Lagrangian, and so the Lagrangian is just one half g mu nu p mu p nu. So equivalently. Use Lagrangian. So now Neil told you that the Lagrangian is actually square root of, so it's just d tau, it's just square root of g mu nu dx mu d, whatever. But the truth is that you don't have to put the square root. Then the Lagrangian has drawn units, but it gives the right equations of motion. In fact, any function of d tau, whatever function you can think of, will give you the right equations of motion, will give you the right geodesic equation. So the Lagrangian is just 1 half g mu nu, and then x mu till x nu prime, where prime is this d over d lambda, and I'll be also using dot, which is d over dt. Okay? So I'll be using this Lagrangian. Or more explicitly in our metric, so I just put, or I see the metric, I just put these primes here. So L, for our case, is just 1 half, now t prime square, and then plus a square g I j 3 0 k x I prime x j prime. So that's my Lagrangian. And of course, I get, by Euler-Lagrange equations, I get the geodesic equations from here. We are not interested in all of them. We just need the time component of these geodesic equations. So, so for t, our Euler-Lagrange equation is that dl over dt is dl over dt prime prime, and that gives me one equation of motion, which is equivalent to GD6. So now what is dl over dt? So this is just t prime. So now I treat t and t prime differently, right, independently. But this doesn't contribute, so it's just a, which depends on t. So I'll have a dot, and that should be factor 2 probably, which I will not write. Okay, 2 a dot, and then I have gij xi prime j prime.
You have 1/2 in front of the Lagrangian, so you don't need to.
Ah, very good. Thanks. Thanks. That wouldn't work. Thanks. Okay, so a dot, and then xi prime xj prime by my definition is just pi pj. Okay. So now I write it again in the same way. I put an a here, and I return it back. So this is just h. And if you look at this definition here, a squared gij pi pj is just p squared. So this is equal to h p squared. On the other hand, this must be equal to dl over dt prime, which is t prime. P prime is p0. And then I have to prime it. So p0 prime and minus sign. So minus p0 prime. Very good. So that's my equation of motion. Now I have to actually be clever and do something with it. And so the simplest way is actually to differentiate this relation here and then plug it into that equation over there. So now let me differentiate this mass shell condition, if you want, for p squared. So if you do it, you get p0 prime minus plus pp dot pp prime equals to 0. So that's differentiating this mass shell condition here. And so this is my second equation. And now I have to I want to combine the first one with the second one. Okay, so let's do it. So here we go. The trick is to look at the following thing. So you write p dot times p. Okay, so p dot is just dp over dt, but I can write it as dp over d lambda over dt. Okay, so I can write it as minus p prime over p zero. This is precisely what I just said. So now for p and p prime, I plug plus p0 prime. Okay. But p0 prime, p0 is gone, so it's just p0 prime. It's minus p0 prime using this equation here. But I know that minus p0 prime is hp squared. From that first equation. Okay, and let's write it. Let's use the definition of h again. I'll put it back. So it's a dot over a p squared. So this is I finished where And this is where I started. So you see that the capital P cancels. And I have a minus sign, but I have P dot divided by P is A dot divided by A up to a sign. So in other words, P dot divided by P minus A dot divided by A. And you can integrate this. So this is like dP over P is dA over A. The solution is the logarithm of this is equal to logarithm of that up to a minus sign. So P is actually proportional to 1 over A. Okay. Very good. So this is a very interesting result. It's of course, you know, it's only one thing which you learn from these geodesic equations, but it's the sufficiently nice result. So let's so far we haven't really apart from this equation here, where I say that the proper time is actually m times lambda. You don't really need that. You can just start with lambda so that p square is minus m square. Okay, so that's the definition of your lambda. So this is still true for both massless and massive particles, this result here. So we can look at both. So first, let me look at the motion of galaxies or motion of massive particles. So motion of galaxies. So we know that for the galaxies, the magnitude of this spatial momentum, well, is just given by the mass times the corresponding velocity. You can check that this v peculiar really is related to this p here. Okay, so this is true for the motion of galaxies. In other words, the v peculiar goes like 1 over a. V peculiar goes like 1 over a. So this random motion of galaxies with respect to the commoving observers actually diminishes as the universe expands. So you know that universe is expanding, A is getting bigger and bigger. So at later and later times, the peculiar velocity, the velocity with respect to the commoving observers, is decreasing. Okay, so this is called Hubble track again. Hubble is everywhere. Hubble track. If you want, so the motion radially comes to rest. With respect to the commoving observer, to commoving observer. So in other words, actually, the specular velocity for random objects in the universe is less and less important, less and less. It actually diminishes as the universe expands. And so if you look at the random object in our universe, the specular velocity is quite small, not really. So random object in the universe has this v peculiar at this point, something like 200 kilometers per second. So you know, typical galaxy or whatever in the universe is almost commoving apart from this local velocity, which is like 200 kilometers per second. So you shouldn't be moving much faster than 200 kilometers per second with respect to the commoving observer at this point. Of course, if you go in the past, it was much bigger. So it was completely random motion, if you want, at the beginning, could have been. But basically, the expansion of universe eliminates this velocity. Okay. So second thing is, let's say, radiation or motion of light. So you know that for light, the magnitude, the spatial magnitude of the momentum is actually equal to the energy. That's for massless particles. This is true. And the energy is proportional to omega, the frequency. So then we are learning from here that omega is proportional to 1 over a. So again, if you started with some radiation, with some frequency omega, then as the universe expands, this is getting bigger and smaller, so the omega decreases. And so this is called cosmological redshift. So this is why the cosmic microwave background actually is now 2.7 Kelvin, because in the past it was much hotter, but now actually its temperature decreased by precisely this 1 over a factor. Okay. So the radiation, the frequency is decreasing. People introduce redshift parameter Z, which is lambda. So by the way, if I talk about lambda, it will be precisely the other way around, right? So lambda is 1 over omega. So lambda is actually proportional to A, if I talk about lambda. So now I define the cosmological redshift as lambda 0 minus. So this is observed. This is emitted divided by lambda emitted. OK, so lambda is proportional to A. So it's A observed minus A emitted divided by A emitted. So it's A T0 A T emitted minus 1. OK? So that's the cosmological redshift. And so people use this set to characterize the distances in the universe. But let's not go into that at this point. Let's just tell you this miracle's beginning of cosmology. And that's the Hubble's law. So if you consider nearby things, so for nearby galaxies, I can expand how the scale factor looks now to how it looked in the past. So A, the emitted is basically A, the observed, and now I'm using the Taylor expansion, 1 plus the emitted minus T observed times H at T0 and so on. So that's the first two terms in Taylor expansion. And so if you rearrange this, you can calculate what this Z is. So Z is this AT0 over AT emitted. AT0 A emitted minus 1. And if you use it here and treat this term as small, then this is just T0 minus T emitted times H now. Okay, just use that tail expansion here. But of course, we are working in the units where C is equal to 1. So then we have C times delta T, okay, which is the distance light travels in that given time. Okay, so this is actually the physical distance, D. And so we have beautiful Hubble's law that this redshift Z is actually given by the physical distance times the Hubble expansion rate here. And we see that this is actually due this cosmological cosmological redshift. So if we observe the galaxy, then we observe that this galaxy emitted some radiation, and we observe that radiation has redshifted according to how far that galaxy is. Okay, this is not what Hubble thought. Hubble thought, actually, yeah, these galaxies are running away from us. And because they are running away and they are emitting radiation, there is a Doppler shift. So actually, originally, Hubble thought of Doppler shift . So because the galaxy is running away, there is a Doppler shift. That's why there is a redshifting of the radiation. And you know that the Doppler shift actually connects how fast the galaxy is running away from you to the speed of light is given by z. So you are actually getting, so now z is, so c is 1. So we have v equals to d times h0. In other words, the galaxies are running away as fast, faster, the further away they are. They are all running away from you, like you started at one point, and then they started running away from you. And so more faster they went, further away they are. And so this is the beginning of cosmology. This is what Hubble actually observed. This is what he measured. And this is called the Hubble's law. He had this interpretation of the Doppler shift. We now know that the right interpretation is actually this cosmological redshift, that as the universe expands, the radiation actually loses energy, and that's why it is redshifted. Okay, so you can make, so this law, of course, is true only if you can neglect these extra terms in the Hubble expansion, which you cannot in general, right? But this cosmological redshift is completely general. It's not only for nearby galaxies, it's forever. Okay, let me stop here. Questions? Okay, see you tomorrow then.